The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Maya Nicholson, Internet Lawfare, with an episode of Rational Security for April 14th, 2024. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Rational Security, a roundtable podcast hosted by Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Alan Z. Rosenstein, in which they discuss the week's top national security news stories. Today's episode is entitled The Eldritch Portents Edition. In the episode, Alan and Quinta sat down with Molly Reynolds to discuss Congress's ongoing argument over the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the growing urgency and continued dispute over U.S. aid to Ukraine between Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and his caucus, and how the accidental identification of a malicious code inside a key piece of software prevented a nationwide catastrophic cyber attack. This is Rational Security.
What was the totality situation in Minnesota, Alan?
It was super lame. I mean, we weren't in the path of the totality. And it was super overcast. So like you couldn't, we basically got, there was zero. There was nothing, bupkis, which was unfortunate, though it meant that my wife and I could take mid-afternoon naps without feeling too bad that we were missing out on anything. What about you guys?
I think here it was like 87% mm-hmm. coverage.
Maximum at 3:20 p.m.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like I mean, presumably the effect is not linear, right? Like,
so actually I found a very cool graph that basically shows brightness against time toward totality, which is not linear. It looks kind of like a log graph, actually.
Yeah, I assume.
But especially because your eyes adjust to the change in brightness initially, like as it gets slightly darker. And then as it approaches totality, it gets rapidly dark very, very quickly. So not only is it like really dark, but your pupils haven't adjusted.
So it's those like last couple of percentages that are really, oh my God, the world is ending.
I had family up in Vermont for totality, and apparently it was pretty cool.
If you had asked me before the eclipse, like, how many people do you know who are going to travel to be in the path of totality? I don't know what I would have told you, but it almost certainly
I would have said zero.
Because like it turns out I knew many people who made this choice. Most of them, I think, including our fine Lawfare colleague, Heyman, went.
And our other colleague, Ohenia.
Yes. But like Heyman went to where she had grown up, which happened to be in the path of totality. But I know other people who were just so committed to this experience that they traveled to places like Indianapolis.
I just think the word totality is so cool. In the path of totality. It's a cool word.
You can definitely see why people were freaked out by it, right? I mean, if you had no understanding of what the hell was going on and you just looked up and the sun was gone, I would be freaked out. I would think the world was ending.
Animals are freaking out at the same time. Definitely would be, you know, world ending fear stuff. Especially when, and this obviously is not a joke original to me, but when coupled with, say, an earthquake in a part of the country that does not usually get earthquakes just a few days prior.
See, these things come in threes, you know, to make it like maximally spooky. So we should be expecting another disaster.
I blame the Jewish space lasers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rational Security. This is the Eldritch Portents edition in honor of the eclipse. I am Quinta Jurassic, and that spooky noise you just heard was my co-host, Ellen Rosenstein.
Hello.
And we are joined by none other than our Brookings and Lawfare colleague, Molly Reynolds, who will explain Congress to us once again. Hello, Molly.
The Congress Whisperer.
I actually prefer Congress Whisperer to Congressional Guru, which is what Ben was calling me for quite some time. So
we can do Congress Whisperer.
Yeah.
Well, as that suggests, listeners, we have many Congress topics for you today. Two out of three, in fact. So our three topics, the first one will be the 702nd times the charm. Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was originally set to expire on December 31st, 2023. But somehow Congress has managed to keep kicking the can down the road, and we're once again in the middle of an argument about whether and to what extent the legislature should reform the Bulk Surveillance Authority. How did we end up here? And is there any indication that Congress will manage to pass a lasting reauthorization in some form this time around? Second topic, Magic Mike. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's troubles do not stop with FISA. He's also tangled up in a prolonged dispute with his caucus over U.S. aid to Ukraine, which is becoming a matter of rapidly increasing urgency, with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warning that his country will lose the war if the aid is not approved. Johnson now says he'll put his own aid package on the table, still tying that to another tranche of aid to Israel. But will the House actually vote this time, or is this just another head fake? And last but not least, Alan's prayers have been answered, and we can finally talk about Linux.
Hell yeah.
Alan actually is responsible for what I'm about to describe. He engineered the whole thing just to talk about Linux. So a few weeks ago, a single software engineer alerted the world to an alarming discovery. Malicious code inside a key piece of Linux software that, had it gone undetected, could have caused a catastrophic cyber attack worldwide. What actually happened here? Is it related to the eclipse? It's not, but I just wanted to say that. And what could stop it from happening again? So for our first topic, I will kick things off. I don't actually know whether this is the 702nd time that we've talked about renewing Section 702 this time around, but it certainly feels like it, listeners. Here we are once again. On Tuesday, the Rules Committee moved forward with some legislation that has been put on the table as kind of the base structure with which the House can itself move forward with a vote on reauthorizing Section 702. We've been kind of tangled in a long-running dispute between sort of, let's call them at a very high altitude, sort of reformers who want some additional restrictions on the Bulk Surveillance Authority, and another camp that would rather reauthorize things in a form that more closely aligns with the way that the statute and the authorities are currently set up. Those were terrible names for the two camps. So if you can come up with anything better, we'll go with that. These two camps have kind of been going back and forth. I think they broadly, though not entirely, align with the House Judiciary Committee on the reform side, bipartisan, and the House Intelligence Committee on the keep it as it is side. And Speaker Johnson has been unsuccessfully, I think it's fair to say, trying to kind of square the circle between these two camps. So Molly, we're going to take it over to you, as always. What is happening, and will Mike Johnson have any luck in actually resolving this issue this time around?
So I think to understand what's happening, there are a couple of ways that it's helpful to zoom out a little bit from where we are right now. So the first gets at this question of camps, as Quinta was describing them. And so I'm channeling Ben a little bit here, because he likes to make this point often, that historically, in the House and Senate, the FISA, foreign surveillance, has been a little bit of a strange bedfellows enterprise, in that in terms of folks who would like to see the authorities of the law limited or reformed in significant ways, historically, that's been kind of a coalition of civil liberties-minded Democrats and a handful of kind of true civil libertarians. So when, for instance, Justin Amash was from Michigan, was still in the House, he was sort of the archetype of this Republican group. And so the idea that we have some alliance between some Democrats and some Republicans in advocating for pretty aggressive changes to FISA, that's not a totally new issue. What is new this go-round is this notion that that group, some Democrats, a couple of Republicans, have been joined by a larger number of Republicans who are kind of, I don't know, anti-deep state might be the way to describe them. Folks who see the issue of 702 and surveillance as prototypical of an overreach by the FBI and this idea that the deep state is spying on Americans.
I'm tapping Trump's wires.
It's a little bit of a caricature here, but this is – it's so, sort of – this dynamic is new to this go-round of the FISA debate. And Quint is right that in the House, we have two – or for several months now, we've had sort of two competing – approaches to reauthorizing FISA 702. One of them has been coming from the House Judiciary Committee, which has both the civil libertarian-minded Democrats and a bunch of these sort of concerned about the FBI-minded Republicans. So you can kind of when the last time we went down this road, if you watched, and really no one needs to do this, but if you watched the House Rules Committee the last time this was going to come up, debate the rule for consideration, you saw, of all people, Jim Jordan and Jerry Nadler appear together to advocate for the House Judiciary Committee's
proposal.
Odd
couple.
Extremely odd couple. And what is, I think, probably, I'm not an expert on this, but probably most central to what that faction wants is a requirement that, a warrant requirement under Section 702 that doesn't currently exist. The other kind of faction in the House is being led by the folks from both parties on the House Intelligence Committee. They would have you, they would want you to believe, Mike Johnson would want you to believe that their proposal does make some changes to FISA. Again, I'm not an expert to the point that I can sort of adjudicate that claim. But, you know, Mike Johnson, in trying to sell the idea of action that is closer to the Intelligence Committee's proposal to his conference, has gone around saying things like, there are 50 reforms to FISA 702 in this proposal that's come out of the Intelligence Committee. So that's sort of one thing to know and just give you kind of a lay of the land on where the two kind of principal factions are. Next thing I'll talk about is Quinta mentioned the Rules Committee, which met yesterday. And in some ways, this is actually – it's a notable development, and it's like a remarkably notable development in that it shouldn't be remarkable. So over the past 6 to 9 months, Mike Johnson – so Kevin McCarthy before Mike Johnson and then Mike Johnson have really lost control of the ability – to bring things to the floor of the House of Representatives via the Rules Committee. So, like, super brief overview of how this generally works. The House Rules Committee, when the House is going to debate a substantive piece of legislation, will meet, will talk about what are the terms under which that bill is going to come to the floor, are there amendments going to be offered, that sort of thing. And then they do what we call report out a rule. That rule goes to the floor. There's a vote on the rule where historically everyone in the majority party votes for it and everyone in the minority party votes against it. And you, as a member of the majority party, are supposed to vote for these things because it's what allows your party to have procedural control over what happens on the floor. And if you stop voting for rules, then it makes it, particularly if your party has a very slim majority, see the current House Republicans, it makes it very hard for your party leader, the speaker, to manage what's happening on the floor. And so over the past 6 to 9 months, basically all of the major things that Congress has done around, say, keeping the government open and funding the government for the balance of the fiscal year have not only required Democratic votes to pass, but have had to come to the floor in a way that doesn't go through the Rules Committee, either because Republicans don't have the votes on the committee itself because they put several Freedom Caucus and Freedom Caucus aligned folks on that committee as one of the concessions that McCarthy made when he was trying to get elected speaker, and or they don't have the votes in the Republican conference to actually adopt these rules on the floor. So why did Mike Johnson have to go through the Rules Committee here? It's because if you bring something to the floor in that kind of other manner that he's been doing with spending bills, you can't amend those bills on the floor. And so it became very clear that if there is a path forward for 702, it's going to have to involve the two factions, the Hipsy faction and the Judiciary faction, to kind of shorthand them. Each faction's going to have to get some amendment votes. They're going to have to get the opportunity to offer some amendments on the floor and then see what happens. So that's kind of where we are. It is the middle of the day Wednesday. I believe the vote on the rule is supposed to happen today. So maybe by the time you're listening to this, this will all have blown up again. But and then if the rule passes, the vote on the bill itself, I believe, is scheduled to happen tomorrow. We can talk a little bit about the sort of key issues that are in these amendments that the House might consider. There are three from kind of the Intel faction, three from the Judiciary faction. I think we should think about them as issues that Johnson is trying to separate from the out of the core bill, either because there's a possibility that they're vote losers if they're definitely in the bill itself, or because they are things on which people who oppose the form that the bill is taking are insisting on getting votes on if they're going to go along with the plan for considering the bill. The last thing that I will say is that you might be asking yourself, well, there are a lot of Democrats who would like to see this FISA reauthorized. Some of them are on the Intel committee. Others are just folks who agree with the idea that the government should be able to keep doing what it's doing. Why would they not help Mike Johnson bring this bill to the floor? Why would they not vote for the rule? Because that's really what the crux of the issue is right now, is do Republicans have the votes to bring the rule to the floor itself? In addition to this strong norm that Republicans have thrown out the window around, if you're in the majority party, you vote for the rule, and if you're in the minority party, you vote against the rule, Republicans have also made it harder on themselves to get Democrats to potentially vote with them on the rule to consider FISA reauthorization by putting the terms for debate for two other unrelated resolutions into the same rule. One of them is a resolution that denounces the Biden administration's immigration policy. Another is one, and here I'm quoting, opposing efforts to place one-sided pressure on Israel with respect to Gaza. So
sure.
Yeah. So it's not I'm not saying that if they had left those things out of the rule that this would be smooth sailing and that you would get Democrats to vote with Republicans on a vote that, again, historically they wouldn't do for kind of party unity reasons. But Republicans, again, and I'm assuming there's a good like intra-Republican reason for putting those things in the rule. I don't know. But it all comes down to there are these just huge divisions within the Republican conference that are just very difficult for Mike Johnson to manage.
So, Alan, what substantively is the fight here? I think the term warrant requirement has been thrown around a lot in recent months as this debate has been ongoing. What is on the table? And also, why is the sort of cohort of Congress that's more closely aligned with the intelligence community on this so opposed to the idea?
Sure. So I apologies to the listener, but in order to do this, I have to explain a little bit of what FISA is, and particularly 702. And I'm scared to do it because it's so complicated. I'm always terrified of getting something wrong here. But the general idea is that 702, and the reason it's often sometimes called a bulk collection program, is that it allows the government to collect large amounts of data about foreign persons abroad, but to collect that data inside the United States. And the reason for this is that when 702 was created, and still to a large extent today, a huge amount of internet traffic goes through the United States because we're the leading, you know, producer of internet technologies and companies, and you know, Google and Microsoft and all these companies are in the United States. So even if the government is trying to collect on foreigners outside the United States, individuals who don't generally have constitutional rights or Fourth Amendment rights, the fact that the government wants to do it in the United, the actual collection in the United States creates some legal, potential legal issues. And so 702 was created to provide a kind of statutory framework by which rather than getting a warrant every time the government wanted to do a search in the United States, it would rather go to this special court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC, and say, hey, here's this program that we're going to do. Here are the general guidelines. Here's how we're going to do targeting. Here's how we're going to do minimization. Here's going to do all this sort of stuff. Sign off on that program, and then we will then do that thing. And that's meant to provide, you know, more privacy safeguards than just letting the government do what it wants to do, but it's less than a warrant, right? Because a warrant, and this is literally in the Constitution, in the Fourth Amendment, has to have probable cause, and in particular has to specify with particularity what the government is seeking to find, evidence of a crime or something like that. And of course, if you're doing bulk collection, by definition, you can't specify in advance the specific thing you're looking for. That's bulk collection. Okay, fine. So now you have all this data. And the problem is that although it's going to contain, hopefully, mostly stuff about foreign individuals, because that was the whole point of the targeting procedures that the FISC signed off on, inevitably, it's going to contain a huge amount of U.S. person information. And this is because foreign individuals are often talking to U.S. persons. And so just this information gets swept up. Okay, so what do you do with that U.S. person information? If it's not relevant to your foreign intelligence, you're supposed to minimize it, okay? But what if it might be relevant to a foreign intelligence investigation? You have this data. So what is the government going to do? Well, the government wants to query it. And right now, the government is allowed to query this massive data with what are called U.S. person identifiers. So these things are like, you know, Molly Reynolds' name, Quinta Jurecic's phone number, Alan Rosenstein's address. If the government can articulate that there's a reasonable chance, a reasonable expectation that using this U.S. person query will create useful foreign intelligence information. But again, this is all on the government's say-so. Now, there are civil libertarians who generally don't like this. They don't like the government being able to do, frankly, anything without a lot of court oversight. But even folks that are more sympathetic to this, there have been some concerns around agencies, in particular the FBI, just doing a very bad job in actually abiding by these requirements. And so there's a great piece we'll link to by Ben Wittes and Preston Marquis, sort of going through sort of examples of the FBI screwing up, not maliciously, but just kind of sloppily. That is an example of why this has become such a controversial issue. So this now finally brings us to the warrant requirement issue that we've talked about. So the intelligence community and its allies in Congress accept that this is a problem. No one's defending sloppiness, but they think that the way to fix that is just to have, you know, even more oversight, even more procedures, you know, give the National Security Division at DOJ, where I used to work, you know, even more money and resources to go and, you know, sit on top of the FBI and audit their stuff. But there's another group, and I would associate this with a sort of, not so much the Republicans who are opposed to FISA, because their complaints are kind of weird and a little more paranoid. But let's call it sort of usually the Democrats or the sort of civil libertarians in Congress who say, no, this is just, there's no internal oversight that's going to be sufficient. The government should have to go to the FISC and get a warrant, like an actual real live, you know, probable cause, particularly specified warrant before it can, you know, put Molly Reynolds' name in that database for a query. And the government does not like this. You know, the arguments that are made are sometimes kind of conceptual, like, well, we have this data already lawfully collected. Why should we need a warrant to access data we already have lawfully collected? Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that argument makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, you can have any warrant system you want. I think the better argument is just more practical, which is it's going to really make it much harder for us to do our jobs if we have to go get a warrant every time we want to look at this data, to which the civil libertarians say, yep, that's exactly the point. And because this is classified, all of this, you know, it's very hard to do the kind of bloodless cost-benefit analysis that you would otherwise do in any other regulatory domain. So, you know, that's the warrant requirement. Now, the last thing I want to say is the warrant requirement, it's not a yes or no thing. There are different versions of the warrant requirement that are being bandied about. So the PCLOB, the President's Civil Liberties Oversight Board, released a report at some point in the past, I don't remember, in which three-member majority suggested a kind of compromise whereby the agencies would be able to enter the U.S. person, to make the U.S. person query without a warrant. But then if the database returned actual results, if they said, yes, there is actually something about Molly Reynolds or Quinta Jurassic or Alan Rosenstein that's responsive to your query, right? Here are seven results. The agency would then have to go to the FISC to get a warrant to look at those results. And so the idea here, the reason it's a compromise, is because since the vast majority of queries don't actually result in positive flags, it would cut down on a lot of unnecessary going to the FISC and wasting of everybody's time. Now, I haven't kind of gone totally into details of what this compromise would look like. So, I mean, I am assuming that the mere fact that a query produced responsive result could not itself be used to bootstrap the probable cause for the warrant. Otherwise, it's not really warrant requirement anymore. It's a rubber stamp. So presumably, it would have to be not just that, you know, Alan Rosenstein came back as there's stuff about him in this database, but and also there's other information that makes us think that this data that's in the database would be relevant to a foreign intelligence investigation and so on and so forth. And so that's the kind of compromise position that, yeah, well, we'll see what happens to it.
That was really helpful, Alan. A couple of things that I'll note from just kind of a congressional politics perspective around this. One is that the version of the warrant requirement that is so should we get past the rule vote and there's an actual debate on the floor of the House with votes on amendments, the version of the warrant requirement that's teed up by the House Rules Committee to be considered is one that has – it's in the form of an amendment with six co-sponsors. Three of them are Republicans, Andy Biggs, Warren Davidson, and Jim Jordan. And three of them are Democrats, Pramila Jayapal, who's the chairwoman of the House Progressive Caucus, Jerry Nadler, who's the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee, and Zoe Lofgren, who's also sort of very much one of these civil libertarian-minded Democrats. So that, I think, should tell us something about like where the House is on this. The fact that that is being offered as an amendment, I think, is a sign probably that the kind of Intel committee faction thinks that that amendment will fail on the floor, that, you know, the people who really want to see it will get their vote, but they won't make it into the bill. It won't be in the version of the bill that would potentially ultimately pass the House and go over to the Senate. We can talk about the Senate in a second. One other thing that something you said made me remember that I wanted to note is another kind of dynamic here that it appears Speaker Johnson has kind of maneuvered or tried to maneuver his way out of is that there is a there's a proposal that's been kind of wrapped up in this reauthorization debate that is generally referred to as the, quote, Fourth Amendment is not for sale act, which is a set of provisions that involve the ability to, in conjunction with surveillance, purchase commercial data that the surveillance itself cannot capture. Notably, that was sort of in the potential mix for being considered as part of FISA reauthorization. What the House what Johnson has sort of indicated that the House may do instead is have a separate vote on that proposal later this week, but at that higher two-thirds threshold. So not take that proposal through the Rules Committee, just bring it to the floor directly, I think under the assumption that it would not get two-thirds as a standalone measure. So that's just like another example of what's going on here. But Quinta, back over to you.
Well, I'm going to kick it right back to you by asking what the situation is in the Senate and how that plays into our understanding of what's happening.
Yeah, so I think the two things that I would note about the Senate, one is that we've just been talking about the quote-unquote warrant requirement in some form. I think it is expected that that's probably a non-starter in the Senate. So if sort of Johnson and folks who want to see this reauthorized. And I should say that Johnson has attempted to maintain some posture of neutrality between the warring factions of his conference on this. I think there are a series of things that have happened that suggest that he is more aligned with the kind of intel faction, but he has tried very hard not to anger the other faction too much. The other faction are Republicans who are also in many cases mad at Johnson about other things, which we'll get to in a little bit. But I think the notion is that if the House were to adopt a warrant requirement, that would make it very hard for that version to pass the Senate, though I think I'm not sure that that's true. The other thing that Johnson and House Republican leadership have been trying to impress upon their conference is that if they cannot get their act together, if they cannot in the House pass something that reauthorizes FISA, the Senate is prepared probably to do something that looks much more like a clean extension that does not make any of the changes that are even in the House Intel Committee's version. And again, I think different people have different perspectives on how much change is actually in the Intel Committee's version and how much is it the Intel Committee trying to sell things as changes that aren't really changes. But there is this sense that, or Johnson at least, is trying to convince House Republicans that if they can't do this themselves, this will be yet another situation where their inability to act and their intra-party divisions are just going to end up with them getting jammed by the Senate.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So moving on to another situation in which the House's inability to get its act together will cause them to get jammed by the Senate. Let's talk about our other...
That's really all I spend my time talking about these days. So happy to take up the next round.
Yeah, look, Molly, when you're on... When we have the privilege of getting you on RATSEC, we try to shut up and let you talk. And I just like to say for all the listeners who don't get to see the visual, Molly just very, you know, she said her thing and then just took a very elegant sip from what I think was a C-SPAN mug. Is that correct? Am I seeing that correctly? Okay.
It is the reward you get if you go on C-SPAN in the mornings and take live C-SPAN callers, which is an experience unlike any other I have had in my life.
They should give you 100 mugs for that.
Just a small digression. I feel like in our world, there's famous and there's nerd famous, which is what people like us actually care about, right? So there's local affiliate NPR. Then there's I was on national NPR. I think taking C-SPAN calls is you're done. You've peaked. How does it feel to have peaked, Molly, is my question.
My personal favorite version of this, and again, I apologize for the digression, is one that comes from a friend of mine who sort of occupies a similar space to me, who told me once that there are two and only two public engagements that bring his old high school girlfriends out of the woodwork to send him emails. One of them is appearing in the New York Times and the other one is appearing on national NPR. So that's like the benchmark that I tend to think about.
I love it. He clearly had good taste in nerdy girlfriends in high school. I approve. Okay, so we've talked about one source of headaches for Mike Johnson. Let's talk about another source of headaches for Mike Johnson, which is these aid bills for Israel and Ukraine. Molly, let me actually start with what's been happening in the Senate. Here it seems a little more straightforward, right? So the Senate has, in fact, voted on a kind of a bipartisan Israel-Ukraine bill. So you just talk about what's happening there, and we can then segue from that into what Magic Mike is trying to deal with.
So on one level, I think in the Senate, there's just a fair amount of frustration about the fact that they did this. There was a lot of frustration about how they got to the point of having something that they could pass. There's a whole torturous episode around were there border-related provisions that the Senate could negotiate and get Senate approval for that then potentially could go over to the House. And that went terribly for Jim Lankford and Chris Murphy and Kyrsten Sinema, who spent a lot of time working, only to have Republicans throw Jim Lankford under the bus in mere hours from when they announced what they had agreed to. And so on one level, I think there's a lot of there's for the folks in the Senate who would like to see additional assistance to Ukraine approved, there's a lot of frustration. There is a faction in the House, in the Senate Republican Conference that is not interested in approving additional assistance to Ukraine without sort of significant changes to the structure of that assistance. And we can talk about what that might look like. But it seems this is a little bit of an overstatement, but it seems like if you ask Mitch McConnell about anything right now, he will pivot the answer to just telling you that the Senate and the House need to approve additional assistance to Ukraine. Like, it continues to be the biggest thing that he appears to care about in the now waning days of his leadership of the Senate Republican Conference. And so I think that's kind of where the Senate is. And I think there is a sense among some Democrats in the House that the most likely scenario that we still get is that the House takes up what the Senate has passed already. I think that is, we can talk about why I think I'm a little skeptical of that. But it actually, at this point, the reason I'm skeptical of that has as much to do with the evolving congressional politics of assistance to Israel as it does with the, actually I would say, sort of static congressional politics of assistance to Ukraine.
Okay, so before we then get to the House, I actually do want to pause and talk actually about the substance of these bills, right? In particular, just the substance of providing aid to Ukraine and aid to Israel. So my sense is that, you know, aid to Israel, while Israel would appreciate it, it's hardly existential for Israel. Israel is a rich country. It is not facing, you know, it is the Goliath here, right? Not the David, although obviously it's a complicated situation. And so funding from the United States to Israel would be nice for Israel. It'd be like a good signal, it'd be a nice gesture, but it's hardly essential for Israel. But that's not the case for Ukraine. And, you know, Quint, as you mentioned in the intro, Ukrainian President Zelensky has basically, well, not basically, he's just very explicitly said, if we do not get this funding, we will lose the war in Russia.
Yeah, more saying this more and more directly as time goes on.
Yeah. And I'm curious actually what you think about that. I mean, obviously, it's pretty clear that aid would be much more useful to Ukraine in a way that, you know, again, it's not existential for Israel. But of course, it is in his interest to say very strongly that he needs that aid or, you know, the Ukraine will, quote unquote, lose, again, whatever that means. I'm sort of curious what you think about that. I mean, do you think this really is kind of an existential moment in the Russia-Ukraine war? Let me start with you, Quinta.
My impression is honestly, yeah, that it is. I think that, I mean, Molly, I'm curious for your perspective as well, because I know you've been in a number of podcasts discussing this with people who are far more expert than I am. But my strong impression is that it is not an exaggeration to say that if the House cannot get it together and approve aid and Ukraine loses the war, it will be the House Republicans' fault. That sounds extreme and like I'm exaggerating. I really don't think that I am. And I actually don't know to what extent it has sunk in among House Republicans and among sort of centrist policy types in DC, the extent to which that is the case. Like the Ukraine is really on a razor's edge right now. They have been, I don't know whether outright retreating or just saying that they're going to need to start retreating, but like the situation is not good. And they have been able to hold on for this long precisely because of these shipments of aid from the US and from Europe. That's really key. And the bottleneck here is the House Republican caucus, which honestly raises, separate from, you know, the fate of Ukraine, which I think is the real consideration here, I think also raises kind of a domestic political question for me, which is, do they realize that? And if they do or if they don't, do they have a sense of what the fallout for them will be? If this happens and people are able to point to them and say, you know, this was you, you did this. I actually don't have a sense of that particularly, or if they care, frankly, or if it's really just posturing. I don't know. Molly, do you?
Yeah. So
well,
I don't.
First off, am I exaggerating?
Not as I understand it. Again, most of what I know here comes from listening to colleagues of ours at Lawfare, at Brookings, in sort of the Washington think tank establishment. So I think
the
one
blob.
One thing that's really unclear to me is, so to kind of situate this within broader dynamics within the House, sort of the Republican Party more generally, but specifically the House Republican Conference, is that sometimes when there is division within, again, especially the Republican Party on some major issue, there are within the sort of people who are saying no, some of those people are true no's, and some of those people are what we often refer to as the vote no, hope yes caucus. And what I don't have a – this goes to sort of your last point, Quinta. What I don't have a great sense of is among the – I'm going to wildly shorthand this – kind of 100-ish House Republicans who have been no votes on additional assistance to Ukraine in some form, how many of them are true no's and how many of them are this sort of vote no but hope this actually gets done and are taking the no position because they feel pressured to do so by President Trump, any number of things. The other thing that I'll note on kind of like thinking about the issue of assistance to Ukraine as related to assistance to Israel is I think it's important to remember that when we started down this particular version of the assistance to Ukraine path, it was before Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. So the kind of first several rounds of this fight were about a proposal that would have had assistance to Ukraine with additional money for the border and then some assistance for – or some additional funds for U.S. operations in like the Asia Pacific, sort of shorthanded as money for Taiwan. And so when the war in Gaza erupted in early October, the initial idea was that, oh – we will add assistance to Israel to this proposal because it might be a vote getter. It might help build a coalition that will also – though it might sway some people who had been no's on assistance to Ukraine and turn them into yeses on a combined assistance proposal.
Poor Mike Johnson.
And the the politics of that in the intervening 6 months have just changed wildly. And so I don't – and this gets sort of back to this question of like what might the House do? And I think it's a real possibility that now they need to take these two things that were connected under the idea that doing the two of them together would help get votes for the thing and cleave them apart because – of the evolving politics of providing additional assistance to Israel. So kind of where, just to wrap up the segment maybe, kind of where we are at the moment is that there are quote-unquote plans for the House to consider some sort of measure providing additional assistance to Ukraine next week. I think plans is doing a lot of the work in that sentence. And there's a lot of debate over the form that that would take. But a big open question for many folks is if Johnson does bring a Ukraine assistance package to the floor, whether it has additional assistance for Israel, whether it's separate from that, who knows? Is that a thing that would trigger the kind of most hardline element in the conference to try and get rid of him in the same way that they got rid of McCarthy last fall? I will say that I am skeptical of that. I certainly could be wrong. I think that many, many Republicans do not have an interest in going through that experience again. And I also think that the chances or the calculations for Democrats of sort of potentially backstopping Johnson in a way that they were unwilling to backstop McCarthy, I think those calculations are different, in part because while, you know, Johnson is very conservative and is not liked for policy reasons by many Democrats, he does not have the same track record of doing things that make each and every element of the Democratic caucus angry in the way that McCarthy did in the run-up to what happened in late September. So you can have me back on in a couple of weeks when I may have to, you know, eat these words. But I am I'm somewhat skeptical that we'd actually see Johnson get deposed over bringing something to the floor in Ukraine. And maybe the answer to that is he just ultimately doesn't do it. But that's kind of where I see that piece of the puzzle.
And now the segment we've all been waiting for.
Yes, the segment we've all been waiting for.
Linux.
So late last month, a Microsoft developer uncovered a backdoor planted in a widely deployed Linux utility called xzutils. I just want to say that I spent a lot of time trying to think about whether I could make a joke about utils from like Econ 101.
Oh, and I that came literally up with, just occurred to me.
I came up with nothing. But I just
what's your XZ utility function?
I wanted to know that I thought about it for a long time.
It's the Pareto optimality of XZ utils.
So this backdoor was detected before it was included in any like production releases for big Linux distributions. But if it hadn't been discovered when it was, the consequences would have been quite large. So, Alan, mostly I want to talk about the national security implications here, but I think it would be helpful to start briefly with just like a basic overview of the underlying environment, computing-wise, that like creates this possibility. So we spend a lot of time saying, "Oh, like X is a national security issue," whatever X is. But can you briefly help us understand why, like as I understand it, there's a widely accepted set of programming practices that like creates the opportunity for what would have been a huge cybersecurity crisis?
Yeah. And so, you know, here I want to reference a great piece that we just published, I think yesterday or Tuesday, by Bruce Schneier on this specific backdoor. And then we've published some great stuff also by Chini Sharma on kind of open source software generally. And I think this really is a story. I mean, there's obviously like a very specific technical point here about xzutils and the SSH utility and the backdoor and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, even I, computer dork that I am, only sort of understand. I mean, the sophistication of this was such that you have to be like a real nerd to really understand what was going on, which again was the whole point. But I think it's more helpful, especially kind of for our purposes, to focus on what it says about open source software generally, because that's really what this is about. And it's both about why open source software is so important and so vital and also screwed up all at the same time. So there's a great, I think it's an XKCD cartoon, which we will also link to the show notes, where it's like, you know, it shows like a giant tower of you know, building blocks, and like the image label is something like, you know, like, I don't know, civilization or something. And then at the very bottom, there's like a tiny little Jenga piece everything's balancing on. And it's labeled like some tiny utility that some dude has been, you know, maintaining in his free time for the last 8 years. And this is how open source works, right? So increasingly, as computer systems have gotten more and more complicated, the job of a programmer developing a new system is less to sort of start from scratch, but to take existing modules and kind of Lego blocks, basically, and build on top of them. And you want to do that. Like, that's clearly the way to do it, because that makes programmers much, much more productive. And it also can create a lot more security if everyone's relying on a relatively narrow set. Narrow here being, you know, a few thousand, you know, a few tens of thousands, which again doesn't seem that narrow, but in the context of our digital world, it's pretty small. A relatively narrow set of really well-developed and well-vetted modules. The problem is that the way that these modules are run is they tend to be open source, which is to say they are run basically by volunteers. They're not generally maintained by companies. And these volunteers are just basically doing this in their free time. Now, again, that's really good because that's created this incredible generativity of the modern open source ecosystem. GitHub, which is one of these open source repositories where, you know, a ton of stuff is hosted, has been incredible because it's allowed people from, you know, all around the world to contribute, right? Some people doing so as, you know, core maintainers, some people like even me who have contributed tiny little bits based on my own, you know, tiny expertise, right? Such as it is in little projects. And it's really, really fun. But the problem is that these maintainers are doing this on a volunteer basis, and they only have a certain amount of bandwidth, and there's no real oversight of them. Basically, the way it works is, you know, someone initially uploads something to GitHub. It's their repository. They have what are called commit privileges, which is basically they're the ones that can authorize the changes that other users submit. And then if the community of programmers decides that that's a good repository, people just use that code. But there's no control over that person's code except that person. There's no mechanism. In addition, those individuals who own the repository have commit privileges. They're the ones who decide who else gets commit privileges. And this is what happened in this case, where the maintainer of this very widely used utility, who was really busy and had some sort of personal issues he was working through, he was approached by another user, a user we now realize was likely the front of an invented persona by some probably nation state actor, given the sophistication, you know, almost certainly either the Russians or the Chinese, who over a period of, you know, months, I think maybe even years, convinced this individual to give him commit privileges by being a useful member of that community. Now, once that person then got commit privileges, then over the next few years, he gave commit privileges to some other people, also probably front individuals for this nation state actor. And then over time, they managed to insert this backdoor. And so this shows a real vulnerability in the open source system, right? Where you have, you know, our entire digital infrastructure relying on these tiny little components that are moderated, that are controlled by volunteers, where there's no like real oversight. And so that's on the one hand a big problem, and it's just a huge vulnerability. On the other hand, the way that this vulnerability was itself discovered shows the upside of open source, which is that because all the code is open, that is literally what open source means, or that's one of the key features of open source software. You can go and read the actual source code. It's not just a kind of machine executable binary that you have to accept on faith that someone gives you. Anyone can look at that. And because there's such a broad community, people can look, and if they think there's a problem, they can go and dig around. And that's exactly what this Microsoft researcher did. And so, you know, it's tricky to know exactly what the lesson here is, because you can sort of spin it either way.
Yeah, which is that, you know, this was obviously like a crisis averted, but what should we take away from the fact that it almost happened? And, you know, it's clear the consequences would have been quite serious. But given everything that you just really helpfully explained to me, as a nerd about many things, but not at all about this, what are the possible like structural responses? Or are we just going to keep operating on the hope that some solitary Microsoft engineer or what have you finds these sorts of efforts in this open source code?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a kind of a range of options. I'm going to sort of put them in three rough buckets. Sort of one bucket is business as usual. So one, you know, the first option is say, no, this worked. This is exactly how it's supposed to work. I mean, it's bad that this person was able to get commit access and inject a backdoor, but the system worked, right? And we should just keep doing what we're doing, and we should make open source even more open, right? We should have even more people involved, and everything should be more open source, because again, the more eyeballs you have on the problem, the better it is. And again, there's some precedent for this. This is in fact how modern cryptography works. It used to be that cryptographic systems were developed in-house and their details were secret. And the idea being that because they were secret, they'd be harder to crack. And in, you know, starting in the 1990s and through today, it's become clear that actually a much better system is to have cryptographic systems where the details are completely public. But because they're public, people can stress test them, and you can design systems that are so good that even though the details are public, like even though, to use a metaphor here, the schematics of the lock are public, it's just so complicated and so well designed, you can't pick the lock, right? So that's kind of one option. Another possibility, this goes sort of all the way to the other end of the spectrum, is to say this is not feasible, right? Like you cannot have a system in which stuff is built on this, you know, group of random utilities designed and maintained by random people, and that this could have been a disaster, and so we have to lock it down. And so, you know, companies need to move away from open source, move to closed source. Maybe we have to go back to sort of what's sometimes called security by obscurity. I haven't seen a lot of suggestions on that because it would be such a tectonic shift, but that is kind of conceptually one possibility. And the third, and I think this is where there's been some interesting work, and honestly, including interesting work by Lawfare. I'm going to use this to plug our ongoing security by design project, in which we're trying to think through, you know, through white papers and blog posts, kind of what security in software and hardware should look like, is to see if we can take sort of the core of open source, but maybe beef it up a little bit. So maybe there are various sort of liability mechanisms that we can add to open source. The most dramatic of which was to make open source developers themselves liable for software. That has huge downsides, and most people don't really advocate for that because that would basically ruin the open source ecosystem. But maybe you could have a situation in which companies that use open source software have to do more work from a liability perspective to vet that software. Or maybe companies move to, instead of a blacklist model where you use all the open source stuff you can get your hands on, except that which is known to be bad, maybe more companies move to a whitelist model where you don't, you know, you only use pre-vetted open source software. Maybe there's also a way to incentivize companies to invest more in maintaining the open source itself, right? You know, if this person who had the thankless job of maintaining this incredibly important but kind of esoteric, you know, utility had more support, right? Had a team behind him, or had other maintainers that were not just randos on the internet that turned out to be the front for the Russian government, but were rather Microsoft and Google researchers who, you know, get 10% free time to do open source stuff, maybe that would have solved that problem. The question there is, how do you align those incentives? Because of course, open source is just a classic example of a public good where you have a tragedy of the commons problem. And so how do you get companies to kind of...
We're just hitting Econ 101
here. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, in a sense, right? I mean, this is... You know, there's the technical piece of this, which is interesting, but I think not super relevant to our discussion. But then there's what I think of as literally the economics of open source. This is much more of an economics problem, in a sense, of how to align incentives than it is even a technical problem if you're thinking about open source. Man, it's so much fun to talk about Linux on this.
And so do we have any sense of who was behind this? Reading about the sort of scheme in Bruce Schneier's post, it's like, it's pretty involved.
Oh, it's super sophisticated. It's super sophisticated both at the, it's sophisticated on two levels, right? So the technical level is sophisticated, right? It's like a backdoor that talks to another backdoor that talks to another backdoor that talks to another backdoor, right? So in that sense, it's just a very complicated technical exploit. But it's also sophisticated in the degree of social engineering that it involved, right? You know, you need someone who understands how open source works, who can ingratiate themselves into community, who can use the right lingo, who can use English in an appropriate way, right? Which might not be native fluency because there are lots of open source developers from all around the world. But, you know, there's a way that crappy intelligence agencies talk when they're trying to do these operations versus good intelligence agencies.
Greetings, friend.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Hello, young people. We don't know who this is. And attribution in cyber security is always difficult. But it seems like this is a level of sophistication that only a well-resourced, probably nation-state adversary could pull off. And there's going to be a lot of forensics, you know, ongoing in the next, you know, weeks and months that we'll see. And you know, I suspect this is something that it's not only computer researchers that are interested in, but, you know, I certainly hope the NSA and CIA are trying to figure this out too, though presumably they won't necessarily tell us based on what they know.
All right. Time for object lessons. Alan, let me start with you.
Sure. So I have two kids, and as they grow older, it's very fun to mark off their heights. And, you know, often that's done just in like a doorway, which is a totally reasonable way to do it. But we wanted to do it with a little more pizzazz. So we got for our older child a giraffe growth chart. It is just a big, beautiful, cute wooden giraffe that is on his wall, but it has a ruler on like one side of the giraffe. And so as he gets older, you can sort of mark off the heights, and it is really sweet. I'm going to leave a link to the Etsy store for this individual who makes these, and obviously they come in many animals. So as our once our younger child gets old enough that we can start tracking, we'll have to get him his own animal. Happy to take suggestions from our followers as to, you know, should it be a zebra or an elephant or whatnot. But it's just really nice. Like, it's like a fun thing. It makes a really fun thing in a little kid's room, and I like to support good Etsy artisans. And it's good for adults too, you know. I mean, you know, we've all stopped growing. Maybe like a weight, maybe like a giraffe, like a hippo weight chart, but that'd be depressing.
Yeah. I mean, we elder millennials that we are, I don't think have approached the part where we start getting shorter. Although the last time I went to the doctor, she told me that she did recently have to tell two people who thought they were 6 feet tall that they were in fact not 6 feet tall. So
that's brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's one of my great regrets in life that I am 5'11" and a half. And
that's
I am not 6 feet tall.
Hair.
So close. Honestly, I am currently probably 6 feet tall. If you add the hair.
Molly, what about you?
Sure. So we talked a lot about Congress this week. We didn't talk about the pending consideration by the Senate of the impeachment articles of Secretary Mayorkas. But in honor of that, I want to commend to everyone my single favorite story from a Senate impeachment trial, which comes from the start of the Clinton impeachment and is detailed in Peter Baker's really excellent book about the Clinton impeachment. It's called The Breach. And is a story about how when the Senate convenes for an impeachment trial, one of the initial things that happen is that all of the senators have to sign this book attesting that they have been sworn in as jurors sitting in an impeachment trial. This is, as an aside, a really great way to determine which senators are left-handed. But in the Clinton impeachment, all the senators go to sign this book, and they have these ceremonial pens that they are to use for the task. And the pens, it turns out, have been misprinted. And instead of saying the United States Senate, they say the Untied States Senate, which really is just
Freudian slip.
Really, just very fitting. This story is recounted in Baker's book. It gets its own entry in the index. There's an entry in the index for misprinted pens. It really is just a delight. And so I offer the story to you. The book is also really excellent, and I think I learned a lot from reading it. So we will we'll link to that as well. Quinta, what about you?
So in honor of Molly's return to Rational Security, I'm recommending a podcast series produced by a regional NPR affiliate.
I am. If there's nothing else that I've accomplished by occasionally appearing on RatSec, I will take converting more people to the cause of listening to regionally produced NPR podcasts.
Yes. So this one is from KUOW and the Seattle Times. It is called Lost Patients. That's patients with a T. And is about the sort of absence of a system, I guess is the best way to describe it, or multiple complicated, not really interlocking systems for dealing with people, for helping people with severe mental illness get treatment. So far, I have only listened to the first 2.5 episodes, but I am enjoying it a great deal. It's really thoughtfully and compassionately done, and I think is kind of a useful context to a lot of the reporting that you see right now about, you know, the crisis of homelessness and other issues in cities and across the country. It adds really useful context to that and includes some really heartrending stories. So highly recommend it, although it will not cheer you up. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. Be sure to visit lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links and past episodes. For our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series, including The Aftermath. Be sure to follow us as well on Twitter at RATLSecurity and leave a rating or review, and sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noah Mosband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by Jen Patia. On behalf of my co-host, Alan, and our special guest, Molly Reynolds, I'm Quinta Jurassic, and we'll talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.